Funding for Think comes from the SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
The worst violence of drug cartels has often been reported to us from south of the border. But American-born kids who see no other future for themselves can be drawn into the cartels, lured by the perceived prestige of working for powerful criminals and the ability to earn fast money and a perverse kind of respect for their ruthlessness. And they can be made into killers. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Journalist Dan Slater is a former reporter for The Wall Street Journal who struck up a correspondence with two contract killers for the Zeta cartel, boys from Laredo who were valued for the easy crossing allowed by their U.S. passports and for their willingness to kill and potentially to die for the organization. Slater's new book is called Wolf Boys, Two American Teenagers and Mexico's Most Dangerous Drug Cartel. Dan, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to start with this. Your book has been banned by the Texas Department of Criminal Justice for people housed in the prison system. What's in it that inmates are drawn to and authorities disapprove of?
Well, there was an excerpt of the book that ran in Texas Monthly Magazine in the September issue. And from what I understand, a lot of the inmates in the Texas state prison system read the excerpt, which kind of created a demand for the book, as an excerpt is supposed to do, which kind of raised the attention of the authorities there. They read the book, and they can ban the book on any basis they want. Here, they just happened to cite the first thing they saw, which surprisingly was all the way on 100, I think page 124, and it referred to, you know, it's a reference to a character who smuggled for a living. And I am sort of, you know, describing this young man's exploits and how he operated and how he would arrange the cars he used to do the smuggling. So they cited that as the basis for the ban.
Did you and your editors anticipate anything like this when you agreed on the final draft of the book?
I don't know if I ever raised the issue with my editors per se. I certainly expected it because I had been dealing with these inmates on, you know, largely a letter-writing basis for the past several years. And in the course of that time, I would send them books that I thought they'd like, books that I thought were maybe a little bit similar to the one that I hoped to write about them. And I'd had a couple of books denied that, you know, I tried to send them. So I had gotten a sense of how sort of easy it is to have a book banned by the TDCJ and how often it happens. I think there's now somewhere in the neighborhood of like 12,000 books on the banned list.
So the central figures in this book are Gabriel Cardona and Bart Retta, both of whom went to prison. Gabriel in particular, Dan, seems like somebody whose life could have gone in a different direction.
I think he could have gone in a different direction. I think when he was younger, a lot of people thought that he might, while at the same time understanding the realities of their neighborhood and of the culture that they're from. He certainly was a promising young man, if you could even call him that. I mean, now I'm referring to the time when he was in junior high, but he was the quarterback of, you know, the junior high football team. He was winning awards in math and English classes. He was attending Sunday school every weekend. He was handsome. He had, you know, he had a lot of character. People liked him. One of his teachers even noted how he used to stick up for the smaller kids on the playground, things like this. So I think he certainly could have gone in a different direction. But his life took a dramatic turn around the beginning of his freshman year of high school when he started hanging out with some other kids in his neighborhood who were a part of, you know, the street gang landscape there. And after that, the spiral, as it is for many kids in Laredo, was very fast.
Your book is a work of nonfiction, but I was struck reading it the same way that watching the movie Goodfellas made me understand for the first time why anybody would ever want to get involved with organized crime. You have really good sort of descriptions here of what the allure would be of the drug trade for a poor kid from the wrong side of the tracks in Laredo, Texas.
Well, yeah, there were so many environmental stimulators, or you can call them whatever you want, instigators, let's say. And, you know, I was very careful with the book. I didn't want to be an apologist for these boys, but I did want to make their best arguments, and I felt like their best arguments were the environmental arguments. I mean, for instance, with, you know, the Cardona family, Gabriel's uncle was a smuggler. A lot of the people in his family were smugglers. He grew up around that, as did many of the kids in the neighborhood where he was raised in Laredo. So to constantly be exposed to that, to be exposed to gang life constantly, to be exposed to the money that one can make so quickly by smuggling immigrants, by smuggling drugs north, but also by smuggling things south. We think of smuggling as a one-way street, but in fact it goes the other way too. And the way he started off was smuggling guns into Texas. Ironically, he would buy those guns from a Laredo policeman, smuggle them into Texas and sell them. Then he started to steal cars in Laredo because there is a huge demand in Mexico for stolen cars. That was a very lucrative thing for him, and that, in fact, was how he met the Zetas. That was how he met the man who would really shape his future, shape his fate.
That's Miguel Trevino, and we'll talk about him in a bit. But I want to talk about your focus here being on these lower-level people within the organization. What made you want to tell this story from the perspective of what amounts to the foot soldiers of the drug wars rather than, you know, the heads of things?
Well, most of the narratives that we see and read about from the drug world are the narratives of the cartel leaders. And I, you know, as someone who was raised in the 80s and 90s, I grew up with movies like Scarface, Goodfellas, which often focus or have a focus on the bosses, you know, the Pablo Escobar stories. You know, the Netflix series Narcos right now is very, very big. That's about Escobar. More recently in Mexico, it's been the cartel leaders like Chapo Guzman was making headlines earlier in the year over the whole thing with Sean Penn. You know, it's no mystery why we love those narratives. They're very dramatic. It's the rise and fall of the mythic boss, the sort of the, you know, bloody rise and fall, the money to be made. But the more I learned about the cartel world, the more I learned about Mexico, the more I began to see that that story that we receive over and over again through movies, through books, through newspapers, really has nothing to do at all with what's happening in Mexico. At its root, the drug war, the cartel wars, is about young men and often boys slaughtering one another. And I thought that if I was going to write a book about this subject, it had to be through their perspectives. Because anything else is just plain fraudulent.
So just south of the border, the Zeta cartel is operating almost unimpeded in Nuevo Laredo. Can you talk about how the Zetas prevent any kind of intervention by police or even by journalists?
Well, much of the media in Mexico, a good segment of the media in Mexico, much, if not all of it in Nuevo Laredo, is on the payroll of a drug organization, of an organized crime organization in some way, shape, or form. It is very hard. Actually, scratch that. It's impossible in a place, as, you know, like Matamoros on the border and Nuevo Laredo on the border, even in, you know, further south, a place like Veracruz on the Gulf Coast, it's very hard to report anything that would be meaningful about what is actually happening in those cities because of the corruption. So yes, much of the media is on the payroll of the cartels, and that's how they control information. The cops, what I discovered is that the police force, and this isn't necessarily new, it was just startling to see this through the eyes of the boys who work for the cartel, but the cops, they're not only paid to look the other way, they're paid to help. There was at least one murder Gabriel committed in Mexico where he walked into a restaurant and shot someone in the back of the head who was sitting down and eating. Now, the cops in Mexico actually cleared out the area for him. And he was able to do that murder, walk out, and then they cleaned up after him. So that's the extent of involvement there.
The Zetas function in many ways like a corporation, and this was really astonishing to me. There are training programs, there are benefits packages, there are defined bonus structures. Tell us a little bit about the operation as it was run in the region by Miguel Treviño that we mentioned before, also known as Z40 or 40.
Yeah, so the Zetas began, just a little bit of history here. The Zetas began as the armed wing of the Gulf Cartel, which has a very long history in Mexico, really going back to, I believe, the 1940s. The Zetas were former military members. They were a member of a unit in Mexico called GAFE, which is G-A-F-E. It stood for Grupo Aeromovil Fuerzas Especiales. And it was sort of like the Green Berets here in the U.S. Many of them began to defect from that military unit in the mid and late 90s to go join the Gulf Cartel, who was hiring and obviously paying much, much better. So that's the way the Zetas started. And as the Zetas and the Gulf Cartel rose together, they started to become known as La Compañía, the company. And they operated eventually according to a corporate ethos. And the main thing there is that, you know, what did it take to be a member? Well, if you made money for the cartel, you were welcome. And once you stopped making money for the cartel, you were no longer welcome. And it was that simple. And so for these boys, the foot soldiers, who were hired to do the dirty work, the same sort of principle applied to violence. If you produced dead bodies, you were very welcome. Once you stopped, you would be disciplined. And, of course, as you mentioned, there were many other features of cartel life that oddly resemble the life of, say, anyone here who works for a company. They would receive a weekly salary in addition to a commission for the jobs they did. They would get vacation. They would get regular vacation. It was called Franco. So there were, yeah, there were many features of the cartel that you know, resembled, you know, a version of a lifestyle that a lot of people here are used to.
At the same time, there were resemblances to the kinds of ruthless and terrifying training we hear about from ISIS or Al-Qaeda. How were young drug gangsters made to prove their appetite for violence?
Well, you showed that in the training camps, and it was... this is the scary thing about the training camps is that the people running them can look at someone and figure out pretty quickly whether this person has an aptitude for the kind of violence that they require. So, you know, you put someone to the task and see if they can do it. And that was really what a lot of the training camp was sort of weeding out those who weren't able to do it. And the ones who were able to do it, they were known as the Frios, the cold ones. And those were the ones who were sent out to do the murders.
We're speaking this hour with journalist Dan Slater, a former reporter for the Wall Street Journal who has a new book out called Wolf Boys, Two American Teenagers and Mexico's Most Dangerous Drug Cartel. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter at @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, where students can customize their degree, like Diane Jay, internationally published creative writer. More at smu.edu/DLS.
This This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Dan Slater, a former reporter for The Wall Street Journal. His new book is called Wolf Boys, Two American Teenagers and Mexico's Most Dangerous Drug Cartel. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Dan, how did Gabriel and Bart catch Trevino's attention?
Well, it actually started one evening in the springtime of Gabriel's 17th year. He was delivering a stolen truck with a friend. It actually wasn't Bart. It was someone else. And they went across the border. They were actually selling it to a cop in Mexico, or they were hoping to sell it to a cop. And so they arrive at the police department in Mexico with the stolen Jeep Cherokee. And they were told that the cop wasn't there. So they got in the car and they start to drive back to the U.S. I mean, we're talking a drive of a couple miles here back over the border. And when they were on their way back to the bridge, they were pulled over by a bunch of black SUVs. And they were brought out of their car. They were handcuffed and they were brought to a horse stall on a ranch outside of town. And they waited there for a little while, really were not too optimistic about their future at this point. They didn't know who had them. They didn't know what, you know, was going to happen. But a little while later, Miguel Trevino and his entourage showed up. And Miguel wanted to know who they were, who they were trying to sell the car to, who they thought they were trying to sell the car to. What had happened is that the cop that they had hoped to sell the car to was, in fact, an enemy of the cartel. And he had been assassinated the day before. So they wanted to know how they knew the cop. They wanted to know what their business was in Nuevo Laredo. This was in 2004 when the Zetas, this was a few years after the Zetas had really arrived in Nuevo Laredo, but they were still in the process of really taking over the area. So they were trying to get rid of anyone who was not on their side. And Gabriel and his friends and his friend, they kept sort of lying and saying, oh, we're law students. We work in McDonald's. They didn't want to tell, you know, the truth, and they were trying to get out of it. Miguel walked out of the horse stall to consult with his associates. He had a hand grenade that it seemed as if he was just going to throw the hand grenade into the barn and be done with these two kids. Shortly before that happened, Gabriel yelled out a name, and this was a name of a fellow who he'd been selling a lot of the guns and the cars to in Mexico over the past few years. And it turned out that this man was in fact a member of the cartel, although Gabriel had never known it for sure. He'd always suspected it. So it turned out that his, you know, his acquaintance with this other guy whom Miguel knew and did business with is what saved him. When Miguel, you know, then met Gabriel and started finding out about his background, the fact that he was American, the fact he'd already been in prison. He had a long rap sheet already at 17. Obviously, the kind of desperate youth that would be attractive to a cartel, but even more so because he was an American. So that's how Gabriel initially got recruited and wound up in the training camp. When he came out of the training camp and went back to Texas and started working for the cartel there, Bart, who was a few years younger, had just gotten out of juvenile detention, where he'd spent 18 months on a series of charges, assaults, marijuana possession, etc. And he was then recruited in turn by Gabriel. So it was really Gabriel who brought Bart into the cartel. Bart, because of, you know, his abilities in this area of violence, actually kind of ascended within the cartel ranks beyond Gabriel. And so later in the story, that becomes a source of contention between, you know, the boys, you know, the competition.
There's certainly an inherent criticism here of the juvenile justice system in Texas. These young men found themselves in trouble well before they were turned into assassins. The time they spent in state custody was anything but rehabilitative.
No, it was not. It was not rehabilitative. I don't know how rehabilitative it is for anyone, but certainly it wasn't for them. I don't know. Again, someone like Bart, I don't know if rehabilitation was ever in the cards for him. Gabriel, perhaps. I mean, one of the striking things about Gabriel's interactions with the justice system over the years before he finally went away to prison for good when he was 19 was that he kept getting arrested in the States, in Laredo, for these murders. He was arrested 3 times, and he kept getting out on bond, and then he would go right back to work. So after that happened once or twice, especially for a boy, a 17-year-old, 18-year-old, you become emboldened. And then when you add to that his experience going to Mexico and working in Mexico, where the cops not only look the other way, but as I said before, actually help him, there's this sense of just total impunity. And so that was the environment that he was operating in, and the justice system to him began to seem irrelevant until, of course, it wasn't.
We're speaking this hour with journalist Dan Slater about his book, Wolf Boys. We'll go to the phones now at 800-933-5372. We have Jose on the line in Arlington. Hi.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Okay, so I'm of Mexican descent, born and raised in Dallas, Texas. I was wondering if the author saw a connection between Mexican culture and the violence that the level of violence that is practiced by these cartels. For one example, is like there's a famous singer who sings a song, Camino Guanajuato, in which he says life has no value. Like that's something that's ingrained in the culture, and I was just wondering, or wanted him to comment on, if he saw maybe a connection between that and the level of violence that we're seeing from the cartel. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Thanks for your
call.
Thank
you. Sure. Yeah, I don't want to paint Mexico with one brush, but certainly there is a lot of what you say going on where maybe life just doesn't have either doesn't have the same value, or there's just a certain fatalism for a certain segment of Mexican society that, you know, they don't love their sons any less than any a family in any other part of the world does, but there's this expectation for some families, for some segments of the society, that their sons will wind up in this world and that they will be useful for a time, deliver money to the family for a time, but eventually it's over. So, is it in their genes? No, but the cultural expectations are certainly not very high.
As I was reading this book, it occurred to me that these young killers have so much in common with child soldiers. But the way we deal with teenage drug gangsters is really different than how we try to care for child soldiers. We do not think of former kids like Gabriel and Bart as victims. We think of them as really responsible for what they've done. How is there a right place to draw the line there?
Well, I think the place to draw the line is at the question of alternatives. So, for instance, the story out of Africa that most people are, most familiar with is this civil war in Sierra Leone in the mid-90s. And, of course, there is an amazing memoir written by a child soldier from that war that was a bestseller here in the States. And I think our common understanding of that situation and situations like it is that a lot of those boys didn't have an option. Oftentimes they live in a place, they live in a town, a village that's literally eradicated. Maybe their families are even gone. And so they actually do fall into some kind of rebel army because there's just nowhere else to go. So I think there's going to be a lot more empathy there. For American boys, even from a city and from a neighborhood as marginalized as the neighborhood of La Azteca in Laredo, where the boys were from, I think there's still an expectation on the part of mainstream society that, hey, they had a choice. Maybe their education system wasn't wonderful. Maybe their families didn't give them the best examples to follow. But they did live in the first world here where there were other options that they decided not to utilize.
Well, speaking of other options, there's another fascinating figure in this book, and that is Laredo Police Detective Robert Garcia. He's like this perfect foil in some ways for Bart and for Gabriel. He was born in Mexico but works in law enforcement in the U.S., had a stint collaborating with the DEA. Can you talk a little bit, tell us a little bit about him and his role in tracking these young contract killers that you've termed wolf boys?
Yeah. He's a very interesting character. He was not the initial inspiration for the book. The initial inspiration for the book was to try to understand the daily lives of these boys who went to work for the cartel. But then as I got further and further into the story, and Robert inevitably became a more prominent character, and the more I learned about his background, he in some ways became more interesting than the boys did. So as you say, he was born in Mexico. He immigrated across the border to South Texas with his family when he was a kid. And his family essentially built their own house on a pile of dirt. I mean, it was a very sort of up from nothing story. He got a college scholarship. He decided to pass it up to enlist in the army instead. That took him abroad to places like England, Portugal. He met his wife in the army. He got married. When they moved back to the States, they moved to Laredo, Texas. He went into law enforcement there. He became a cop at about the age of 22 or 23. And as a street cop in Laredo in the 90s, you inevitably handled a lot of drug busts. And so he really enjoyed that work. He felt like he was making an impact back then. And you weren't just taking drugs off the street. You were also eradicating the crime that went along with the drug world. Someone steals a stereo or a car to get the drugs. And so he felt like he was making a difference there. What then happened is that in his late 20s, he was, you know, won like the Cop of the Year award, and he was hired as a task force officer by DEA. So he had a six-year stint with DEA. He went over to the federal side, and that's when he got a more global view on the drug war, and that was when he really realized that drug interdiction had zero effect on the drug supply, and that everything he thought he'd been doing for the past several years had been futile. So when he returned to Laredo PD at around the age of 34 or 35, he decided to leave the drug investigations behind, and he became a homicide detective. He felt like that would be a way to have a more meaningful impact on the society that he served. And so it was in that capacity that he pursued the Wolf Boys. He became a homicide detective shortly before they joined the cartel. So, you know, every time that Gabriel was arrested for these various murders and he went into the Laredo police station, it was Robert Garcia who was interrogating him. And during these interviews, I mean, the interviews are surreal because Gabriel feels free to basically tell Robert about everything that he's doing in Mexico because he knows that Robert can't touch him for any of his crimes. So you have this 17, 18-year-old kid sitting there just being completely forthcoming about this brutal violence in Mexico. And meanwhile, it's in fact true that Robert can't do anything about it. There isn't anyone in Mexico who Robert can call. There's no fellow cop. There's no hotline that he can call to collaborate on an investigation. And then so the kid goes in, you know, to jail, and then he gets out on bond and he goes right back. So Robert pursued the boys for about a year and a half until finally he teamed up with DEA again. And they did this huge investigation. They actually had an informant inside the cartel. They were able to rent a safe house in Laredo. And I don't want to say anything more than that without a spoiler alert. But so anyway, that was, you know, Robert's interaction with them.
Robert Garcia is also a parent who is keenly aware of the risk to young people who succumb to bad choices. There are times in the book where I'm cheering for him in dealing with his own kids and times when I just sort of cringe.
Yeah, I think when I set out and this is funny in retrospect, when I set out to write the book, the last thing I thought I was writing was a book that would have parenting as a theme. I mean, now looking back, it seems obvious because you're writing about these kids who really fall through the cracks and wind up doing horrible things. So, of course, parenting was a big role, or the lack of parenting, or the lack of oversight, at least, was a big role in the lives of people like Bart Retta and the lives of people like Gabriel Cardona. And it was also important in Robert's family. It was important in the way that he was raised. Even though his family had nothing, his father really had his head on, and he was all about work, discipline, and Robert tried to take that into his own family when he had two sons. And so when you're a parent in Laredo and your boys are going to these high schools, especially on the south side of Laredo, which is where Robert's sons went to high school, they're going to, I mean, those are bad, bad high schools. They really are. There are no resources there. There's a lot of violence there. There's a lot of drugs there. And so as a parent, you really need to be almost militant. And so Robert took sort of a strong arm approach with his boys. And one time that even entailed, you know, calling up the police department, asking for a squad car to come to his house to take his older son to juvenile prison for a night, just because he wanted him to do that. He wanted him to have that experience.
We're speaking this hour with Dan Slater. He's a journalist who's just written a book called Wolf Boys, Two American Teenagers and Mexico's Most Dangerous Drug Cartel. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can find me on Twitter at KERA Think, or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program, presenting a complimentary lecture series on the American presidential election in 2016 this fall with SMU political scientist and distinguished professor Dennis Simon. You can RSVP at mls@smu.edu.
Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Dan Slater about his new book, Wolf Boys, Two American Teenagers and Mexico's Most Dangerous Drug Cartel. You just heard La Clave Privada, and for people who don't speak Spanish, Dan, can you tell us about that song?
La Clave Privada is a song by a very famous singer of the Narco Corrido, and it's essentially a song about the allure of being a kingpin, the allure of being in the narco world and having lots of money and power. And it's the type of song that that sort of, you know, the cartels and the cartel bosses use to brand themselves, use to brand the lifestyle. And so boys along the border and boys in Mexico listen to these songs and they aspire to the life.
It's chilling because it's a great example of a narco corrido that is very upbeat. And, you know, if you're not really thinking much about it, it sounds like it might be some kind of true hero narrative.
Well, it absolutely is. And, of course, you know, the bands who specialize in these kinds of songs, they get a lot of flack, but they, you know, reply that, hey, we don't, the world, this, you know, the drug world, the cartel world doesn't exist because of us. We're sort of the artists or the journalists who are just explaining it. But it absolutely is hero worship. And, you know, funny enough, even that can be bought in Mexico. Miguel Trevino, for instance, and a lot of the bosses and the Zetas and the Gulf Cartel, they would often pay pay a Narco Corrido singer to write songs about them. Almost like, you know, on commission, the same way that someone may have a portrait made of their family, and they would pay them a lot of money. And it was also, funny enough, it was a way to launder money, too, in Mexico.
All right. Can you talk a little bit about the sense you got of whether Gabriel in particular was at all affected by the number of murders that he committed for money?
Was he affected by the number of murders? I think on some level he must have been. I mean, obviously it required a level of desensitization. He achieved that through taking essentially roofies, the pills that we know here as roofies. They're actually illegal in the U.S., but they're very easily obtainable in Mexico. So that was one way he would render himself insensate. And I think that, you know, he would rely on that to do the murders. He was also very young, and for a young boy without a fully developed conscience, it's probably easier to adapt to the lifestyle. Is he still affected now? You know, he turned 30 the day the book was published last week. He's been in prison since he was 19, and he'll be there for the rest of his life. Is he still affected? That was not something we discussed so much. My sense is that it was so ingrained in him as such a young man that maybe he's not as affected in the way that we'd think of, for instance, you know, a soldier who goes to war in his 20s and comes home, you know, may be, but I'm not sure.
What do you know about how these kids who are doing these crimes justify them to themselves? Do they? Is there a reason that they say this is there? It wasn't such a bad thing to do.
Well, I think Robert Garcia, the homicide detective who ultimately tracked them down, probably put it most aptly from the perspective of the boys and from his own perspective. Even the very first time that I met Robert, the first time I was in Laredo, I said, what do you think of their victims? What do you think of the people who they killed on behalf of the cartel? He said, they were all pieces of shit. Sorry to use that word, but that's what he said. You know, it was the, I don't, that didn't make it into the book. It probably should have. But there's your perspective from a cop. So if, you know, if he thinks that, imagine what the boys think from their perspective. No one's innocent. No one's innocent. And there was even a time where Bart, one of the murders that Bart committed in Laredo, was a murder of a fairly high level drug smuggler, who was pulling out of the parking lot of a restaurant. And in the passenger seat, he had his wife, who was pregnant. She was about 8 months pregnant. And in the back was his brother and his 3-year-old son. And Bart opened fire into the car at point-blank range, and he only killed the smuggler, the person who he was meant to kill, but some bullet fragments hit the abdomen and the back of the pregnant woman. And that was just something that was very hard for me to think about, to write about. But the more I, you know, got to know these boys, the more I got to know that world, the more I could at least see things from their perspective. And their perspective is that if you're the wife of a drug smuggler, you're the wife of a person who has also killed many people, you are not innocent. You're in this. So there was, allegedly sort of, a principle within the Zetas that you would try to leave families out of it. But in practice, that was not always followed.
Regardless of culpability, these are just horrifying outcomes all around. Did you come to any, are you sympathetic now to Robert Garcia's sense that the drug war is pointless? What do you think could be done to clean up the violence, if nothing else?
Well, I don't think it's one thing. I would love to be able to say it's one thing or even three things that I could point to. It's so many things, and I think it starts at home, and it starts with poverty, and it starts with the breaking apart of families, and with a lack of opportunity, and with marginalization. Laredo is probably the most marginalized community in this country. It's certainly one of the poorest, and one of the least ethnically diverse. It's about 97 or 98% Hispanic. So I think as a country, we need to do a better job of fighting poverty, as cliche as that sounds, but also of bringing marginalized communities into the fold, thinking about education, thinking about jobs. The drug policy stuff is another subject, and I can talk about that all day long, but it's hard to talk about that in a vacuum without discussing family life.
Can you talk a little bit about your, establishing a relationship via correspondence with these men, and whether your feelings about them changed, whether you were kind of revolted at times to find that you cared something for them, given what they have admitted they've done?
You said it all. I was totally conflicted the whole time. The relationships were extremely intense. It was very scary for me at times. And like any long-term relationship, these relationships had their ups and downs. We'd have little spats. We'd get in fights. We would write sort of, curt letters to one another, and then, the chill would thaw and we'd be back at it. But, it was a very intense relationship, especially with Gabriel, which was the primary relationship and the longest relationship. We now have exchanged almost 1,000 pages of letters over the past 3 years. And I know so much about his life. When you know a lot about someone's life, it's a lot easier to feel empathy for them. I think that fear of the other is a symptom of the distance that we stand from one another now. And a lot of what we're seeing right now politically is sort of the tendency to polarize, the tendency to feel that the other is always bad, is a product of fear and is a product of not knowing. So I guess in some ways Wolf Boys was, as a book, as a project, was my attempt to try to get as close to as I could to this segment of humanity, this segment of the world, this segment of existence that scared me. I wanted to find out what it was really about, and I think in that process I did certainly feel, I do feel some affection for Gabriel. We have a relationship. I am very friendly with his older brother, Luis, who right now is back in prison on another smuggling charge. I am friendly with his mother, and I spend a lot of time with these people. You spend time with people, it's hard not to become friendly and to understand one another. I think that it's important to remember also that Gabriel, he's now been in prison for 11 years, and so he's pretty far removed from the things he did when he was 17, 18, and 19. He has grown and evolved quite a bit even in prison, and I've seen a little bit of that evolution myself in the past 3 years.
Wolf boys is a term that you coined. Tell us how you arrived at that.
The way I arrived at wolf boys, it started when Gabriel told me that the young cartel members, so members of the Zetas, the bosses, the comandantes, they have Z and then a code, Z and then a number. So as you said earlier, Miguel Trevino, known as Z40. And so the higher level folks in the cartel had Z and something. The foot soldiers, the younger boys, they had a different code. Their code was an L and then a number. An L in Spanish is L. So they were known as the L's. And L stood for Lobo, which means wolf. And I think the light bulb went off in my head while I was writing the book. I was rereading Lord of the Flies. Which is not, I was reading it randomly. I wasn't reading it because I thought it had any particular resonance for the project. I was just reading it. I pulled it off the shelf. But it's about what happens to a group of boys who are left alone, who are alone on an island. And, you know, they turn on one another. And so I started to see Laredo through that Lord of the Flies lens. And so the idea of wolf boys, the idea of, you know, raised by wolves, raised without any oversight, seemed particularly apt.
When someone knows they will spend the rest of their life in prison, what kind of planning for the future takes place?
It's so day by day. Gabriel doesn't know, for instance, if he'll survive forever in prison. He made some enemies out there, and you never know. So it's really day by day. And I think one of the things that's hardest for him, that has been hard for him in prison, is that he feels useless to his family. And one of the ways that he built his sort of own identity when he was a youngster was he was the guy who provided for his family. He took a lot of pride in that. And now they're the people that have to provide for him. They have to put some money in his account so he can buy envelopes and paper and writing, implements in order to correspond and things like that. So I think that's been very hard for him. And it's just existence. It's kind of day to day. He has hope on some level that he's going to fight his case, or that some new piece of evidence is going to come up, and I think he needs to hold on to that. That's just what he has to do for himself, is he has to hold on to the hope there.
Dan Slater's new book is called Wolf Boys: Two American Teenagers and Mexico's Most Dangerous Drug Cartel. Dan, thanks very much for making time for us today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered today by Eric Bright. Shelley Canavy's not here because she had a baby yesterday, and we're very happy for her. Samantha Guzman is associate producer with help on the phones from Javier Girabet, and our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.